West Legal Aid Center would like to welcome you to the audio program, The Way Forward for the Eurozone, Dissolution or Federalism. Thank you for joining our presenters, Matthew Herlock, a partner with Kirkland & Ellis of New York, and Hans Humes, President and Chief Investment Officer of Greylock Capital Management of New York. Thank you for joining us, and I will now turn things over to our speakers.
Hello, this is Matthew Herlock, and together with Hans Humes. And what I wanted to do for today's presentation is to address basically what the title is, The Way Forward for the Eurozone, Dissolution or Federalism, and sort of get behind that question and address the question in two ways. I'm a lawyer. I've been looking at the Eurozone for a long time, and particularly in the last year, given all the problems, been looking at it and thinking about it. And what I wanted to do as a lead-in is lay out a structure, kind of a theoretical structure of how we got to where we are, where we currently are, and where I think that is likely to lead to. And then Hans, who can present his own presentation, obviously, but he's much closer to the front lines and was negotiating the Greek restructuring and has been involved with Spain and is looking at Italy and France as well. And so he can give a lot more granular and frontline view and perspective on what's going on in Europe and with the institutions, in particular the debtor countries and the troika of the IMF, EC, and ECB. Okay, with that introduction, I'm going to go forward and go through my presentation, which again is somewhat general. What I would say is I don't get too much into detail because if anything, with everything that comes out in the newspapers every day, we are drowned in detail. And what I'm trying to get to is presenting it in a much simpler format and just say, this is how we got here, these are the issues, and this is where it leads to, I do believe, and I welcome any questions about that. Anyway, when the Eurozone was formed, effectively through the Maastricht Treaty of 1992, but there was obviously tremendous precedent, after World War II, the formation of the European Coal and Steel Community, and then from there into the European Union. The goals of the leaders who were obviously looking forward and trying to create a unified system throughout Europe, what they really wanted to do was develop a common market to enhance trade among the European countries, to establish a system of common governance to help manage that system of trade. There's a question mark in my presentation because that is a problem right there. And then lastly, to help support that and help facilitate the trade, to have a common currency. As you may have read or seen, that also was included in the Maastricht Treaty. It provided for the Eurozone currency, the euro, and as you will have noted by reading the newspapers, it did not provide for a way out. Of course, laws can be changed and there is a way out, but there is not currently one in law. Now, the benefits of these principles were obvious at the time and still are. By having a unified zone without notable customs barriers in between and some common governance, you had a very efficient and inexpensive trade relative to what existed before. And that trade, plus related benefits, helps develop economic growth and social development. And the hope was that this increasing trade and exchange between the countries would help increase political integration and bring Europe closer together, again, with the underlying goal there of avoiding the misery that had preceded in the first half of the 20th century. Now, the problem with the system stemming from before, but certainly since the Maastricht Treaty of 92, was that while they set out the principles and had the clear goals in mind, within the system there were limited controls because of the underlying key issue, which you'll see at the bottom of the page. But the result was, while they provided for a common currency and common governance and all these things, there were actually limited controls on sovereign debt incurrence, i.e. how much any individual government could borrow. There were no laws nor enforcer of that. There were limited controls on the banking sector, which with the increased integration, as we all know and have seen, there are much bigger banks which have a much broader European spread, not many fewer simply national banks. But there was no overall controller of those banks or guarantor of deposits in those banks. And then lastly, there were limited controls on the governments themselves and their cost incurrence and spending. I note these because all of these have come up as issues in the last 3 years, and they have affected different countries different ways, but they are all alive and have all appeared as problems. The result of this was fairly obvious. The system works well in times of growth and common interest. From 1999 to 2007, it was basically straight growth, and while there was underlying that growth incurrence of many of the problems that that have surfaced badly today, such as Greece did overspend and increase its public sector quite a bit, and Spain didn't haul in its banks and let them lend too much to real estate developers. It generally worked well. People were moving in the same direction. After the crisis in 2008, and particularly the bankruptcy of Lehman, et cetera, the recessionary pressures began, and the lack of internal controls throughout the Eurozone started to make it come unglued. And this was and is an ongoing process of increasing intensity, I would say. The underlying problem, which became clear and becomes increasingly clear, is that the countries in the Eurozone and their citizens are unwilling to cede authority to an unknown central authority. If you look back over the history, since 92, the Maastricht Treaty, the Great Britain bounced out of the European rate mechanism, where they had everybody had a different exchange rate, and then Italy had to be devalued, Ireland had to be devalued, and so there were always little control problems along the way, and they made up, even post-crisis, they have the European Financial Stability Fund, which has sort of enough money, but as it turns out, not enough money. There are partial steps to create structures that might help, but they're all insufficient because at the end of the day, nobody wants to cede adequate authority to a central power which remains undefined and which people remain worried would not have their best interests at heart. So, as I noted, the financial crisis of 2008 really caused the euro system to come under pressure. And I was looking back through a timeline earlier, and in 2009, 2008 was a crisis. 2009, government deficit spending ballooned as tax revenues declined from based on less economic activity, less asset value within the countries. So even countries that had been relatively disciplined as to their government budgets, which including in that, I would say Ireland was quite disciplined. Spain certainly relative had as people have pointed out to me often, they had lower debt on their books than Germany, which had trouble meeting the deficit targets in the mid 90s and early 2000s. But anyway, the deficits started to grow and pressure started to grow with it, and that led to the 2010 and 2011 series of bailouts, first of Greece and then of Ireland, because the government couldn't handle the guarantee of the banks when the government had assumed the debt of the banks and said, we will guarantee the payment of that. It created just a huge deficit, which Ireland couldn't meet. Portugal had similar problems. And as these problems arose, there was growing concern about Italy and Spain as well, which is what we're seeing today. We come to 2012, and you've got the Greek restructuring in March, which did succeed in cutting private sector debt, but according to the themes that I'm underlining here, it didn't actually address any of the underlying problems, which is, while Greece could cut its debt, okay, but how do we then control its ability, how do we limit its ability to incur debt in the future, and how do we get it to cut its to its huge government costs, since that's a major employer in Greece, and other issues. And the result of the Greek restructuring, people turned their attention to Spain and Italy, as they had in the summer of 2011 as well. People started to get concerned again, focusing on the issue of, okay, Spain, okay, maybe they don't have a lot of government debt, but they've got this massive bank debt. The banks have large asset values, but they haven't devalued the real estate, which they funded. And so the banking system is looking quite shaky. We're scary about that. And ultimately, we are going to view it as a sovereign obligation. I think that is how the markets are seeing it, even though it isn't currently the case that the government is responsible for propping up the banks in Spain. I think the EU, when it looks at providing support to the Spanish banking system, at some one of the debates is, do we make the government ultimately liable? Do we get some guarantee from them? And that comes as much from the pressure of the citizens of the creditor countries like Germany and Netherlands and Finland, et cetera, who are uncomfortable just giving their tax money to the Spanish banking system without some sort of guaranteed backup. Italy similarly has faced similar pressure on its borrowing costs because Italy has a very large amount of debt on the government books. As long as people have confidence in Italy's ability to repay it, it is an amount that seems to be sustainable and repayable. However, if people start to get concerned, as they are currently, about Italy's ability to repay that, they'll demand higher interest on their debt, as they are, and that makes it increasingly difficult for Italy, which does have to refinance a large amount of debt every year, to pay that debt. And if the pressure keeps growing, the costs keep growing, and at a certain point, that can become unsustainable. The one country I haven't pointed out here, which is highly relevant and might be relevant in connection with any ultimate outcome, is France, which also has a large amount of government debt. People still seem to have confidence in France, but if they should lose that confidence, such as feeling that having a socialist president who's going to overspend and not have adequate taxes to pay those expenses, you know, they might start to put pressure on France, and that would put real pressure on the Eurozone system. To turn to what are the consequences of this gradual decline, it has in the public sector obvious political effects. First, it has created a meaningful divergence within the Eurozone between the creditor and the debtor countries, and you could also say the northern and the southern countries. When people are thinking about solutions, they say, "Oh, well, we could have the Euro 1 and the Euro 2. We could have the currency of the north and the currency of the south." I'm not going to go into that for the purpose of this presentation. I can answer questions about it, but I don't think that that is a solution to this problem because it doesn't still address the underlying problem. What we're seeing on an increasing basis as well is political dysfunction. I ask the question, who speaks for whom? That's becoming clearer and clearer as dissatisfaction is growing and growing. You have people speaking, you know, you have the German Angela Merkel says one thing, and then maybe the Minister of Finance says something else, and another person says something else and says, I disagree with that. Similarly, what you're seeing, again, this is anecdotal and you see it in the newspapers. For example, there are people in Germany who are paying things with marks, saying, you know, that's our currency, not the euro. And there are businessmen and banks that are accepting that. On the other hand, one also hears that French banks are not permitting any document to ever refer to any successor currency in France other than the euro. There's a standard provision, as people know, in bond documents and contracts saying it will be the euro or any successor currency which shall be legal tender in France or in any other country. And many French banks are not permitting that reference because they don't want to accept that the euro could ever go away. where we currently find ourselves, and this is an ongoing reality, is no sustainable solutions can be found. I point in my slide to the solution found in the June 28th meeting of European leaders, where they talked about having a banking a deposit guarantee system and a more centralized regulatory system for the Eurozone, for banks within the Eurozone. And so for a relatively long period, 5 days or so, there was some calm. But then you started to hear from the Finns and the Dutch and within Germany that they didn't like that, because ultimately what they didn't like was their tax money going to fund debts and systems to control debts in other parts of the Eurozone over which they ultimately have no control. Their view would be, why is my money going to fund them when it does me no good and I have no certainty that it will do them or the Eurozone any good? No. And that level of disagreement and discontent is only growing. And I would say one hears the same in the South, in Italy and Spain, as austerity to meet the expectations of, let's say, the creditor countries, and austerity becomes increasingly imposed, certainly in Greece, certainly in Spain, and certainly in Italy. It causes increasing unhappiness within those countries, and at the same time, the markets don't seem to provide any relief in terms of borrowing costs or credit for the steps that have been taken, because at some level, people don't see a solution being proposed. They say, okay, you've cut the costs, but you still got a lot of debt, and I have no certainty that you'll be able to repay it or that it won't increase. What we are seeing is a system. You've got a number of productive and quite wealthy countries within a system which, when time is good, it works very well, but there aren't the fundamental controls that need to be there for it to work. And why is that the case? Because I am now on my last page, page 6. That is the case because the key issue, as it always has been and continues to be, is ceding control to a central authority, ceding sovereign control to a central authority. People just aren't comfortable with that. The Germans aren't, French aren't, Spanish aren't, Italians aren't. No one is, and that simply remains the case. I think the view of the European leaders in 92 and prior to that was, if we create this system, we will enhance unity, and that unity will naturally lead to greater integration, which will allow for the creation of a central authority. What we're seeing is that, while I would note Europe is much closer now to greater unity and perhaps permitting a central authority to have power, it's not there yet. And there is a fundamental mental change that has to happen, which hasn't happened yet. And therefore, that is what leads me to my view, and I will accept that it is my view, that an inevitable result of this is that where Europe seems to be headed currently is to some kind of crisis or imminent crisis, which will lead people to focus on what is the fundamental question. And that crisis is a default of one of the major sovereigns within Europe, and I suspect it's Spain and Italy, or Italy, and ultimately also pressure on France. It could be, frankly, I think if one threatened to go, the pressure would rise on all of them, such that that would be a crisis unto itself. It's not one I hope for at all, but I do view it as increasingly inevitable, because there is nothing short of that will put adequate pressure on politicians. And this is not a negative to politicians, but they have to they have to do what their electorate wants. And currently, their electorate doesn't want them to cede control to a central authority. Understandable. And they want to get reelected, so they do what the electorate wants. There's only so far they can push. And I would say that's true. I think Merkel recognizes that. She can only do what her people will permit. And so I think, unfortunately, the situation is one that has to lead to a crisis where people have to look at the two roads, which are, okay, I would note default, the costs of that would be significant. I am a lawyer. I won't focus on the details of that, but, if a country defaults and then one of the major countries defaults, it's going to be hard to save. And so if you then say, let's get rid of the euro, let's dissolve the eurozone, the economic costs of that, just in terms of just contracts, which would be uninterpretable or unpredictably interpretable, and therefore business would be you couldn't carry it on. There is a tremendous cost there, which I think people are aware of. And should we get to that point, that's the one choice. That's the scary choice. The other choice is federalism. Do we create a manageable system for the eurozone? What we're seeing is, while it could sound like an easy choice, it's not an easy choice. It is my view that it's a hard enough choice that it's only going to be made when people's backs are unpleasantly close to the wall, and they will need to really think about it. I'm talking with people in the eurozone. They see it a bit the way I see it, and what they would say is they think that there's a greater than 50% chance that leaders would understand that their people want to go towards greater federalism, and people would accept that. But as the situation becomes increasingly tense, there is a slightly growing and not insignificant possibility that people might say, I don't care the cost. It has to go to dissolution. The consequence of that to the global economy is would be very unfortunate. That's a different subject, but I do think that's the choice we'll get to. In talking with Hans, who I will turn to very shortly, as I say, the solutions are actually pretty clear. I mean, you do need to have a greater central authority that takes in tax revenue and allocates it where needed, and you need a more centralized banking regulatory system so that the economies are more integrated and work in a more interactive and functional way. But we're not there yet, and I think the only way we'll get there is in a more unpleasant circumstance. Having said that, I now turn it over to Hans, who is welcome to and may well disagree with much of what I've said, but what is particularly useful about what he has to say is he's on the front lines, involved with the negotiations, talking to the institutions, and so I think he can give us much more concrete detail on this. So thank you. I turn it over to Hans now.
Well, thanks, Matt, and thank you all for calling in. I hope that none of you were planning on getting any opinion that there was either going to be a move towards federalism or a move towards dissolution from us, and an explanation of why one or the other was going to happen for sure, and thereby giving some clarity going into the future, because unfortunately I'm somewhat like Matt, maybe a bit more from a trader perspective, but I see both possibilities quite clearly, and I think in my vantage point, investing in this area, I have to just sort of assign probabilities. And I think I agree with Matt that the politicians have a time-tested and time-proven ability to postpone decisions until a crisis forces their hands. And my concern in this situation is that the crisis seems to move more and more to a point where it's going to force their hand to break it apart. My opinion, being involved in it, I mean, just by way of background, I was on the steering committee for the Greek restructuring. I guess we were the only U.S. fund to have a seat at the table there, and we're also involved in many of the discussions behind that are going on currently to try to make sure that the private sector still has a voice at the table in how the Spanish bank restructurings might go. I think what we're trying to do is make sure that it's not too creditor unfriendly a process, because our concern is that if it is, that could create a lot of the crisis environment that would may precipitate a breakup. I'm afraid I'm not particularly good at sort of following a slide presentation in order, and I think I'm going to pull something out that Matt was talking about on the on really the issues on federalizing and establishing sort of a central organization that might provide deposit insurance, and just sort of the psychology of the man on the street, because it's extremely important, just like the psychology of the markets is extremely important. And I think that one of the big things that we're dealing with here is not just that there are many disparate states and 17 voices that might pop up and give opinions in the process, and certainly that's a huge structural flaw in Europe, that there isn't a designated authority to speak on behalf of the Eurozone, despite the fact that in these negotiations with Greece and now with Spain, that the Troika and to some extent Germany is calling the shots, not the borrower. But underpinning a lot of this is just a distrust of the financial system and of the banking system. And that's really what is causing a lot of the erosion in confidence and a flight of capital. Just to give you some sense of the environment over there, obviously in the United States, bankers are hardly the most popular people out there, but in the last meetings I had in Paris, in this working group around sort of hopefully building some kind of better model for restructuring than the one we had in Greece, one of the French bankers came up to me and said, you know, how are things going? I said, well, it's fine. We'll see what happens. And he says, well, it's really bad over here. And what's going on? It's like, we're the most hated people in this country. And I said, well, how can you be more hated than I am as a hedge fund guy? I mean, we're the really bad guys. And he says, you have no idea. So when you see this in the United States, a lot of the rhetoric, but I don't think you get the visceral hatred. And the hatred towards the financial system there really cuts very deeply. I mean, and a very destabilizing effect in the restructurings is that at some level, many of the big decision makers, like the Germans, feel that financial transactions are immoral. So there's no sort of sense that if you strip apart the confidence in the financial system, you're really going to undermine the entire economies. And that, coupled with the sort of the confidence in the markets and the inability to provide a clear message on how they're going to manage this crisis, is leading this situation to potentially a fracture point. With that, I guess I will step back and start at the beginning of my slides. This is a very simple sort of depiction of the Eurozone and the countries. And I think what jumps out, now this is sort of looking backwards at 2010, 2011, but I think the thing that should jump out to you is the outlier countries, Greece, Italy, are ones that have been in focus. Spain, which is now the focus of the market's attention, their debt-to-GDP number is actually quite reasonable, and in fact, their deficit of percentage of GDP is not horrendous. It looks like it should be relatively manageable in the context. I mean, it is a driver, and it's sort of, I think Germany is the flip side of it. But overall, the problem with Spain is clearly not a sovereign debt problem. And if you look at the indebtedness of, as Matt pointed out, France and Germany, those are situations that look relatively stable by most measurements, but I think if you look at what could happen in the markets, as Matt pointed out, if those start to deteriorate for any reason, you could see some more instability in the Eurozone in general. I was speaking about this before. The confidence is for me, the big biggest issue. The leaders have not been able to frame a consistent message for the population and potentially, more importantly, the international community. And the ramifications of that is the discontent in their particular countries and a shift in what the population might want to vote for creates the inherent stress between the political aspirations of the politicians and the economic necessities of trying to keep the Eurozone intact. And the fact that the multilateral institutions and then the ECB as a central authority has a pretty narrow mandate and hasn't been allowed to sort of be expanded without a lot of ratcheting back and forth is creating a lot of stress on the whole system. I think that the real thing that many of the official sector participants in these conversations have had is just not understanding that you can't isolate this problem. Mm-hmm. We've seen time and time again over the last sort of 6-9 months that there's talk of ring fencing one country, putting one country out and ring fencing the euro as if that will solve the problem. And 3-4 months ago, Matt and I were at a conference, and a multilateral representative was explaining why Spain didn't have a problem. And I could have quibbled with the numbers, but the reality was that at that moment, money was flowing out of the Spanish banking system, and Greece was sort of teetering. There's either an inability to recognize publicly that there was going to be contagion or an inability to recognize it. And that's really a problem. Because if the Europeans don't understand that the market gets scared and it's not a global conspiracy either by the man on the street or the markets to punish countries or punish the euro, but just individuals seeking to protect themselves either by selling a bond before it falls off a cliff or taking your money out temporarily from a domestic bank and putting it offshore until the crisis passes, then they don't get it. And that, to me, is probably the most important thing, that if they do get it, there is a chance. If they don't get it, it's a problem. So coming to my last slide, that's the issue that I see right now. The conversations we're having around the Spanish banks, it's really difficult, and I think that there's a lack of appreciation that not including the private sector in the discussions and how this restructuring on the financial system should work is really of grave concern. If the private sector is ignored, if things are done in a wholesale manner, that senior bondholders are hit incredibly heavily regardless of the health of the institution. Going back to Ireland, I think the biggest mistake they made is there should have been a very big distinction between how creditors to Anglo-Irish were treated as opposed to allied Irish. Basic, credit superiority with one bank versus another. At that moment, the Eurozone felt that all senior debt for all the banks should be treated as virtually sovereign risk. I thought it was a bad idea, and I think what Ireland has ended up doing has resulted in turning a financial system crisis to a sovereign crisis that they're still working through now. Iceland, on the other hand, sort of punished all the banks, creditors, and they've been able to issue in the international markets quite easily. If they just throw everything into a bucket and do something that punishes everybody in the capital structure, regardless of the credit quality of the institution, I think the private sector is going to not just be concerned about Spain, but it's going to be concerned about the decision-making process in the entire Eurozone, because ultimately the people who are making the decisions on how this is getting done are not the Spaniards. The real critical issue that I see right now is, and Matt touched upon this as well, but both France and Spain went to the markets yesterday and issued 5-year debt. Spain issued at 6.5%. France issued at 0.86%. I think this, in a nutshell, illustrates the psychology of the market. It's not rational. People aren't looking at this in any way, other way than an emotional way. Most of the buyers of each of the country's debt are the local institutions. There are obviously international buyers to the French debt. But the yields, and it's been acknowledged by the French officials, are unrealistically low. If this is a flight to quality trade. You know, the French banks still have the confidence to come into their markets or still have the capital base to do it. In Spain, the local banks are really under pressure, and nobody's going to buy internationally. Why is that? Is there a fundamental difference in quality between the risk of one country versus the other? I mean, you go back to the first slide, you'll see that the debt-to-GDP of France is actually worse than Spain. So what's going on here? It's confidence. You have to make an argument that the financial situation, the financial institution situation in France is really not any better than that of Spain. Spain's got all the real estate loans. The stuff on the balance sheet is probably mismarked. There's probably too much leverage. Well, the leverage is probably even worse in France. And the credit quality, if it's marginally better now, it can erode very, very quickly if there's a blow to confidence in the markets. These banks will teeter as easily as the Spanish banks did. So this is the split between the two countries can be something that could reverse very easily if the emotions in the market change. If things run out of control in Europe because of the mismanagement by the politicians on the information flow and an explanation of strategy going forward, then we will see a convergence of these two, 6.5 to 0.8. And the convergence is going to be just the spreads in France blow out. There'll be a loss of confidence, and then I think things run out of control. Now, that's a worst-case scenario. I don't necessarily think it's going to happen. In my discussions with all the players, I have seen a grudging movement by the European politicians to sort of understand that while they may feel that markets are immoral, that they're not going anywhere, and that they have to manage it better. I hope that they understand how important it is to manage the confidence of the market and manage the confidence of the man on the street. And if they can tamper down the volatility, it's going to be a much better process either way, either if they federalize or if they decide to dissolve. My sense is the political commitment to the euro is extremely strong. It's just the costs of that commitment may be higher in terms of, you know, elections and actually paying than a lot of the decision makers want to acknowledge. But I think the Germans are finally starting to realize that the collateral damage to their economy and a dissolution will be pretty extraordinary. So I've actually, despite looking at it and seeing what things can go wrong and how bad it could get, I've got a reasonable amount of confidence. I mean, one of the key things for me is when we sat down and spoke to him in the last few go-rounds, we were talking about how dangerous August can be, just because historically bad crises have tended to happen then and everybody takes vacation. Therefore, if there's volatility in the markets, there may not be enough decision makers there to stabilize prices if they fall. And they actually understood that. So I don't think that there's going to be a crisis next month. But there's some really tough decisions to be made. And as Matt pointed out as well, there seemed to be progress coming out of the June 28th summit meetings. And then everything was qualified in the aftermath. And they need to get that under control. So let's see what happens in the next few months. I'm afraid I don't have an answer if it's going to dissolve or if they're going to federalize. I mean, if either situation, it's either going to happen abruptly over time. And, you know, the world's been through this kind of event before, and things will adjust. So I don't think anybody needs to be terrified of what happens one way or the other.
I would, and Hans, thank you. A couple things. One, I would invite people to send in their questions if you'd like. We have one which we will answer shortly. just to try and to tie our presentations together and our discussions, I mean, what I was pointing to is a systemic, you know, the system's got, it's got to go one way or the other because the system doesn't work. The word you were using more often, which I didn't use, but which is clearly relevant, was confidence. And what, and the other thing was irrationality, that, you know, why people are trading French debt one way and Spanish debt another on the books doesn't make any sense. And from your perspective, how does that link up to a system that I would say from a practical perspective on the long-term basis doesn't work? Is there a link? And do you, how would you connect those, or do you?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing. I'm thinking about it from a couple of different angles. It's, you know, to some extent, when they're building this model, they didn't factor in that markets can act irrationally for a long time. And they're you know, mm-hmm. I think it's a failure by most policy people to, you know, think that you write things down on paper and base it on all sorts of cool studies, and then it just works. And I've dealt with that mm-hmm. with a lot of the guys in Washington. I'm sure you have, too. And they didn't put in place right from the get-go that that a time like this might happen, and how do you deal with it? And I think the U.S. is much better. We might do it in fits and starts, but, you know, there seems to be a much better sensibility to be proactive is better than doing nothing. And the kicking the can down the road is fine as long as there's a game plan, you know, around kicking the can down the road. In terms of dealing, I think it's a, it needs to be an element in the decisions. And if you read between the lines of what the French are saying, they get it. It just needs to be laid out a little bit more that, okay, that there's a lot of irrationality in here, and you can get it to become more rational, either with, you know, an abrupt break, and then things will sort of pull together in some form or another, or with a game plan. And that is the issue. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, what do you want to happen? You want the maybe French yields to come out to, you know, 1.5% or 2%, and Spanish yields come down to that level. You know, what could happen if you mismanage is everything blows out and there's no confidence, and nobody in the private sector will, you know, lend to any of these sovereigns except for maybe
right.
Switzerland and Germany.
Right. And I mean, I guess what I would think is there is the because the distinction I'd also make is when I think about it, I think it's a that the markets are saying the system doesn't work, and you haven't proposed an answer yet that works. We're going to penalize you until we see something that works.
Yeah, but I mean, I think the solutions, the broad solutions, have been out there for quite some time. You know,
right.
get an FDIC in place. You know, you don't have to. You know, the thing that drives me nuts is, you know, the Europeans will sit there and say, well, you know, we're not going to be able to get all that stuff up in time for it to matter. It's like, no, you don't get it. Just say you're going to do it. Then start putting in it, you know, in place. If you just say, we'll do depository insurance, all right, the Germans don't want to do an issuance of euro, you know, mutualizing the debt. Fine, come up with something that works for you guys, because you're going to have to do it in some form or another unless you're going to do direct transfers. Just say you're going to do something and stick to it. And there will that's the game changer, is understanding that this is a confidence game right now.
And to push it into back to the June 28th, where the leaders did basically say that's what we're going to do when we're going to have a regulator. And for a few days, everybody said, ah, yes, they're getting there. That's the answer. But then the voices started to pipe up. No, we don't want to do that. The Finns, the Dutch, the Germans. And that seems to be getting louder as the process winds along. Go ahead.
Put it this way. You know, I had a meeting with one of the lawyers who's been, you know, a pretty big architect on a lot of these restructurings. And he and I have been through all sorts of wars in you know, what's now known as emerging markets. And I think that after seeing what we've seen, we kind of laughed at that. But, yeah, they said this, the they said the right things, and then it started dissolving into a lot of noise. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's unfortunate that you can look at something like that and say, oh, my gosh, there they go again, because, you know, it's not good for the international framework. However, you know, it's at some point it's amusing, like, you know, if you can laugh about, you know, the behavior of the Ecuadorian politicians on one hand and laugh at the Europeans. And, that, you know, one of the things I've really had trouble with is this crisis was so obvious from mm-hmm. 2008, 2009, 2010. The Europeans mm-hmm. were in denial. No, this is different. This is different. We're Europe. And even in regard to Greece, and if you look historically, Greece has restructured pretty much every time that the Latin countries have. It's not different. Mm-hmm. None of these situations are different. So trying to opt out of doing what you're supposed to do in these situations because you're different, that just doesn't work. And hopefully they'll learn now, if things get pushed to the edge, that listen, the solutions the market wants, and to some extent what your population wants, they may not know it, but they want the stability. They don't want mm-hmm. to have a financial catastrophe. So explain to them what the impact. Okay, you the politicians hate banks, population hates the banks. Why don't you walk them through what happens if your financial system collapses, and mm-hmm. and make them understand that this is actually going to be better. And then
yeah.
call it for what it is. Appoint a couple people who speak for the Euro region and tell the other guys to shut up.
And yeah.
Then you can work with something. But if you can't do that, fine. Let's sit down. Let's start figuring out how to, you know, pull it all apart.
And based on your experience, the argument I made in defense of politicians is, well, to the extent they can or should be defended, is that they see that, as you say, they're getting closer to seeing that, but that their electorates aren't ready to give up what needs to be given up to create a real solution. Would you agree with that? Or
yeah, I mean, and unfortunately, that sort of kicks it back to, you know, make an effort to, you know, listen, one of the biggest problems I've seen is you have very strong voices. All right, the Finns, they're creating havoc in this. I mean, somebody mm-hmm. needs to pull them aside and tell them, listen, guys, you're not really that significant in the whole Europe scheme, so be quiet. If you have to go away. You know, because they're looking for guarantees on everything. I mean, that was one of the biggest disturbing things is, you know, okay, $100 billion of new debt for the financial system, and then they want it guaranteed by Spain, so it becomes part of the sovereign debt to GDP.
Sovereignty,
and then
right.
you know, they made all this noise about not subordinating us, and then of course they're, you know, going back on that. And what's driving that? If it's the Finns and the Dutch, that's, you know, all right, that should be manageable. If it's the Germans, because they can't get any consensus within the country. I mean, you know, I've heard talk about how there are many key decision makers in Germany who feel very strongly that they can go it alone. You know, I may be
right.
wrong, but I don't think that they know what the cost is if they decide to go that way, especially in this environment.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose my view, what I would say is I can't, again, looking at the system and its weakness, I can't blame the Finns and Dutch too much in the sense that what their people are saying is, why are our tax dollars going to those people over there?
So
why aren't they helping us?
It's no different. Listen, I'm half Dutch.
Yeah.
You know, when
yeah.
we were voting on the European Constitution back a few years ago, I sat with my relatives and I was like, listen, well, you know, why are you doing this? Well, we want Europe. You know, we want to make sure that there's no war. It's like, all right, fine, do a currency union with Germany. But you guys are probably per capita going to be paying out more than anybody else to these southern countries. They knew it full well going in. I mean, one of the things that was driving me nuts about the whole morality play that Germany was turning the Greek saga into was, you know, they're complaining about something they knew full well what Greece was when they let him in. And they let him in for political reasons to offset the Turks. So it's like, guys, you let him in. You drove this one because you didn't want a bunch of Turks coming across the border. And then, you know, so they're no different than they were, mm-hmm. you know, when you let him in. You let him in for political reasons. There's an economic cost. Pay the cost. It's incidental.
Yeah. I hear you. I mean, but now it all gets revisited when the cash actually has to come out. I would note, I want to now touch on a question that we have talking about the Greek situation. situation, which I'd like to leave more to you because you were at the table and involved. The question is, please elaborate on PSI and consequences. It has been criticized for pulling EU's public finances in an absurd, vicious circle. Should there have been other alternatives considered? I do leave it to you. All I would note is the PSI was a good short-term solution where it basically had the private sector took the hit. The more public sector debt was put on, and the public sector took no hit. From my perspective, the issue was it didn't actually address any of the underlying problems. Not that that was what was being asked. So I'm not blaming anyone. I'm just saying the problems are still there because they weren't addressed.
The problem is in the structure of the Greek economy?
Yes, effectively. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, to be...
But you hold for it. You know this better than I.
Yep. The structural problems that I saw was that we weren't really negotiating with the Greeks. We were negotiating with the Troika and then the Germans. So we'd come to some sort of accord with the Greeks, and then it'd get vetoed, and we'd have to go back to the drawing board. In terms of... I mean, they had to sign off on this letter of intent or the memorandum on the reforms. But it was de facto, it was like we had a gun to our head and the Greeks had a gun to their head that this wouldn't get done unless we both agreed to something that was really kind of unpalatable. The structural problem on the PSI is we took a hit that if it had been taken across the board, Greece would have no problem. But we actually took more of a hit than we really should have because of the $300 billion, $60 billion of the bonds were being held in either the ECB, and these were bonds that were bought to support prices when prices were going down, or in the other central banks where they were held as investment accounts. So this is not any kind of intervention in markets to support prices. This is stuff that the central banks had bought for investment purposes. Many of the people on the steering committee were insurance companies and banks who were told by their governments and by all the European authorities not to sell the bonds. And, you know, that at the last minute, without consultation to us, that $60 billion between the ECB and the other central banks was swept out and was, they're swapped for another Greek credit, and we ended up having to take a further hit. They were like, then everybody came back and said, look, now this is unsustainable, and if you look at the PSI calculations by the IMF, we've got to move, your cash component down to this, and we need to do this on the coupons. It's like, wait a second, you just swept out a bunch of stuff that shouldn't have been swept out. There's no difference in what type of account most of the stuff was held in. Moreover, the stuff that the ECB bought at a discount, and frankly, probably many of the other central banks. Was converted at par. So let's say they bought this stuff at 70. You basically increased the hit to us because this moved at 100 cents in the dollar. There wasn't even a recognition of the discount they bought it at. So, penalized us without us having any voice in it, and it didn't solve the problems. But I mean, the nice thing about it is we're under UK law now. Most of the banks and the insurance companies that held the Greek debt have sold. It's pretty much held in the hands of hedge funds. So if they try to come to the table, it's going to be a very different creditor committee. I don't think there's any contemplation whatsoever that the private sector will restructure again. It's not in the cards at all from what I can see. The official sector is going to have to take some form of a hit. And that's being...
If the private sector doesn't negotiate, does that means that you default, or is that effectively what Greece has to face?
They don't need to do anything because, they could retire all this stuff for $12 billion right now where it's trading. It's 25% of the outstanding debt right now. The cost of servicing with the coupons are... Our coupons currently are about half of what the official sector debt has on most of its loans. So, the nice thing about it is the official sector can just refinance from, one pocket or another. So the restructuring that will occur on the official sector debt will happen probably away from the headlines. So I don't think it's going to exacerbate any crisis. It's really odd. odd, but I think that the Greek bonds are probably the safest haven in Europe right now.
Because the public sector won't take a...
No, the public sector will restructure. They're already doing it in some one form or another. These things are trading at 15 cents on the dollar, down from sort of 25 when, you know, after the exchange. All the banks are out. And, you know, so they just... they're not going to be forced sellers if there's an additional euro crisis, because it's already moved in the hands of people who are holding it for the long term and aren't subject to a tap on the shoulder. And frankly, if you look at it, Greece out of the euro, in the euro, if they put everything back together, these things can go from 15 to, I mean, you know, to 2 to stepping up to 3% coupon. If you, you know, it could be trading, you know, trade 100 wide to more than 100 wide to France at 100 cents on the dollar. It's trading at 15 cents on the dollar. And,
yeah. Yeah. Anyway. That leads me to one other question, and I hope we've answered that question. Is if we I have now forgotten the question for a second, but is Greece? Greece's borrowing costs haven't. Where are we in to try and plug our presentations together? Where would how do you have a sense? I mean, can be kicked down the road for another 5 years,
what,
20 years,
Greece?
Or do you think this is the Eurozone challenge?
I mean, my view.
Do you have a feel for timing?
Yeah, I mean, Greece is just not an issue. It can be funded.
Yeah,
you know, within the Eurozone, outside the Eurozone, the economy is just not big enough to matter.
Right.
The what'll drive the, you know, so kicking the can down the road with Greece is, I think, you know, a little bit of noise at the very worst. It was the canary in the coal mine. It was the catalyst to start getting people to look at the structural imbalances in the Eurozone. The kicking the can down the road with Italy, Spain, you know, Portugal, small, and potentially France. That's something where if you each country on its own has a solution to its debt problems, and they're different. You know, it depends on whether it's a sovereign crisis or a financial system crisis. But you can do it, and we've learned enough in the last few years that you can figure out a way to make all these things come back into balance. And in terms of adjusting, you know, salaries and so forth, there's nothing that's out there that's too difficult to manage. It's going to require sort of a political consensus in Europe and a sense of direction where we're going. And then also understanding, you know, that, fine, it's not kicking the can down the road, as I said before. It's time can be your friend, and it can allow the banks to get their balance sheets back in order. We saw that in the U.S. in the 1980s when, you know, most of the money center banks had far too much Latin American debt, and the government was, you know, really helped to, you know, not force the issue on the banks and allow them to, you know, make money in whatever way, playing the yield curve to get their balance sheets back in order. We saw it in Chile, and which was a financial system crisis. So it's you know, I just think that Greece is just a non-event. It never really was the focus.
Mm-hmm. And then, to return to my last slide, then would you agree or disagree with my suggestion that an inevitable choice will have to be made? Because what you're suggesting is maybe not.
I think you're right that, you know, that a choice needs to be made. I wish they'd make it now. They may just have to make it when their back's against the wall. I've been sort of arguing, trying to point out that the market volatility introduces too much chaos into the decision-making process, and that there needs to be some rational thinking right now to look forward and say, okay, where do we want to get to? If they can't sort of pull themselves in together and there are too many disparate elements in the conversation, then it probably will be that this erodes and the market will force a break.
Right. And I get that's from a non-trader's perspective. I mean, that's sort of where why I say inevitable is the way the system is working. That's why I see things headed that way because, as you say, rational people could fix this. Each country could fix its problem, and the problem could go away. But that's just not happening because a solution is proposed, like the June 28th proposal, and then it gets people start squeaking. That's not me. So that they can't get the backing to find the solution, so the problem doesn't go away.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the problem is we're stuck in the middle because, when you talk about sovereignty, not wanting to give up sovereignty. I mean, the reality is we're neither here nor there. Greece and Spain aren't making the decisions about the money they owe. It's the
right.
And the Germans with the veto. There's already been a huge surrender of sovereignty. To some extent, it needs to flip back to the Germans and say, guys, it's great that you give all these prescriptions, but you're also going to have to submit, if you want everybody else to submit, to an independent FDIC central bank. Mm-hmm. You've got to tell your politicians to just, be quiet. You're going to have to also do things that you don't like because
yes.
in the interest of the better whole. They haven't got that yet. The Northern Europeans are approaching this as a morality, as a moral issue, and it's, they're the ones introducing a lot of the chaos.
Yeah.
And
right. The voices are piping up against solutions. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So fine, you guys don't want to do it. Fine, just call it. But you can't.
Right.
You can't expect. You have to understand that the things you're demanding will make the whole system not work. So,
right.
If you guys want all these other countries to surrender their sovereignty to an independent central authority, you have to do it as well. And if they say that you need to do X, Y, Z in the same way that those of us in New York, we don't really complain that much about how much money comes out of our pocket and goes to the states that
Federal
don't
government.
Have a vibrant economy. That's just the mm-hmm. way it happens.
Right. But we all benefit. We all would, at some level, agree that we benefit from the collective.
Yeah, I mean, and that's where it really comes down to, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. And then one other question, just because I it may be on people's minds, it's certainly a question I ask. Well, and when you're talking about Greece, so people say, and you also referred to it in your comments. So let's kick out the. Let's kick out the Greeks. Let's kick out the Portuguese. Let's kick out the Irish. And if we have, let's kick out the Spanish. Let's kick out the Italians too. I mean, where are we at if it ends up being? Is it possible to make it a smaller eurozone? Two, does it make any sense to do that?
The more sensible solution would be to kick out the Germans and let the Deutschmark appreciate. But that, I used to think you'd trim a few countries out. And, all right, you can manage it, but in this environment, you can't.
Mm-hmm.
If you kick out the Greeks, then people will run at Spain. I mean, Greece, Portugal, who cares? But, Spain, Italy, all right, so you're talking about, the fourth and third largest economies. All right, well, then people are going to look at France vis-a-vis Germany.
Yeah.
The outlier is the northern countries.
Mm-hmm.
So...
who have benefited also from the euro.
So, but we'll see. Unfortunately, given the way things are moving, it's not clear to me. The only thing that's clear to me is it's not going to blow up next month.
Right, fair enough. Right. Hey, what I would say is I agree with that. Because of its 17 countries, because of the multitude of voices and lack of clear commitment from the people and therefore their governments, the crisis that I foresee becomes somewhat inevitable. Because there ain't another answer that people will support, it seems.
Yeah, I mean I'd kind of agree. I think they've got an opportunity to pull it in. I've seen some
yes.
good signs that they are sort of understanding, but they're much better than they were 6 months ago, but they might not get it quickly enough.
I suspect that is the case.
So you're probably
And you would agree dissolution would just be an economic nightmare. It would spread broadly to the globe. I do think that's... there's not a clean solution on that front.
You know, I've been through this plenty of times before, but I think I'd probably just turn off the lights and come back in 6 months and figure out what the world looks like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Too much noise.
Yeah. Okay. I don't have other questions to answer from our audience, but do you have any other any comments you'd like to make to conclude? Because I think we're coming to the
end. No, I think that's about it.
Very good. Okay, well, look, thank you very much, Hans, because your frontline experience is obviously directly relevant. As I say, I do think we're in the middle of a tricky time. Will a solution be found short of the choice that I think will have to be made? It will be interesting to see. There are obviously smart people trying to find such a solution. I just, I think we may end up having to face that final choice because that's what the politics will require. And that's when a solution will come. An answer will come one way or the other. And I would be happy to propose a solution, but that's beyond the scope of today's meeting. So, thank you all very much. Thank you, Hans. And obviously, if you have any questions, let us know. Okay. Thank you, Hans. I am now going to sign off. Thanks.
Thank you for selecting West Legal Ed Center. For optimal savings, why not consider a customized subscription? You'll get unlimited access to the largest, most current CLE library offered online. Call 1-866-765-MCLE for more information on how to maximize this opportunity. That's 1-866-765-MCLE for continuing education that's always comprehensive, always relevant, always current.